Your hands were made for greatness. Mighty hands for painting, paneling, and clicking the submit order button on homedepot.com to get that duvet. And these Egyptian cotton towels delivered right to your door. Do more with decor at the Home Depot. Save up to 30% on select bedding and bath. Now at homedepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Enter promo code bedbath15 at purchase for an extra 15% off. Visit homedepot.com for more information.
Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and foster care. Today we're going to be talking about a new federal legislation called the Family First Prevention Services Act, also known a lot by the Family First Act. And this act is a recent act, and it has the potential to dramatically change the child welfare system or the funding thereof across the country. This is a really important topic, one we've gotten a lot of questions on. I think you're really going to enjoy the information we provide. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
The 12-month clock starts when a child been determined in a stated kind of case plan by the 4E agency as a candidate for foster care, which is just another way of saying that sort of without the use of these services, the plan for this kid initially would at least be to be removed into care.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Foster Care National Adoption and Foster Care Education and Support Nonprofit. You'd think that I'd have that one down pat, wouldn't you? I'm Dawn Davenport. I am your host and the director of Creating a Family. And you can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by the Jockey Being Family Foundation. Their mission is to strengthen adoptive families through post-adoption services. As their founder, Deborah Waller, chairman and CEO of Jockey International, says, one failed adoption is one too many. You can support their mission by buying a bear or a blanket at jockeybeingfamily.com. And we thank them for their support. This show is also provided support through our partners, and one of our partners is Adoptions from Shepherd Care. Adoptions by Shepherd Care is a nonprofit adoption agency founded in 1980. They provide domestic infant adoption, international adoption from Colombia, and domestic and Hague-approved international home studies. Their mission is to provide competent and compassionate adoption services to expectant and birth parents, prospective adoptive parents, and most important, children needing a forever family. And we thank them for their support. Today, we're going to be talking with John Kelly, editor-in-chief at the Chronicle of Social Change, about a new federal legislation, the Family First Prevention Services Act, which was signed into law as part of the Bipartisan Budget Act on February 9 of this year, 2018. John Kelly is the editor-in-chief, as I mentioned, of the Chronicles of Social Change, and he has written extensively on this act and has read it thoroughly, so that both help. Welcome, John, to Creating a Family. We're so glad to have you to help us understand what has been or is, at this point, a confusing act.
Thanks for having me on, Dawn. I did, in fact, at one time read all 103 pages of the law, so I'm certainly no complete expert on everything in it, but I'll do my best to to share what I know and what I've heard from others on it.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to start just by giving everybody, I don't think, this is oftentimes we think that our audience may be up to speed on things. In this case, I suspect they're not. So I'm going to start with just a really general summary of the Family First Act. And the act reforms the federal child welfare financing system under Title 4E and Title 4B of the Social Security Act. And it's to provide, and the revisions are to provide services to families who are at risk of entering the child welfare system with an aim to prevent kids from entering foster care by allowing federal reimbursement funds for things like mental health services, substance use treatment, and in-home parenting skills and training. It also, a second part, also seeks to reduce placement of children in what they're calling congregate care or what we often call group homes. So that's just a real rough overview of a summary, just to kind of get everybody on the same page. John, in the past, the Title IV e-funds could be used only to help pay for cost of kids in foster care, things like admin costs, training costs, things like that, as well as adoption incentives. Is that right? Is that the change? In the past, the funds were used for supporting children in foster care. Now the goal is to being used to preventing kids from entering foster care. Is that an oversimplification, or is that about right?
I think that's about right. I mean, absolutely on the main tenet there. I mean, the 4E structure thus far has funded states in part for their placements in foster care and for adoptions that they finalized for kids in foster care. Now, there's certainly been, probably a lot of your listeners are aware of, lots of different waivers that states have gotten to do various kind of experimentation within 4E. Some states and locations like Los Angeles and Florida have gotten pretty flexible waivers from the rules to kind of test out prevention services already. So there has been experimentation, and I think the people who put this law together would tell you that their law was informed by to some extent by those experiments. But yeah, what this does is inject a kind of layer at the front of 4E that doesn't necessarily constitute, widespread prevention of abuse and neglect, but instead really focuses on, supporting states in their efforts to prevent the need for foster care in cases where there has already been, a problem has already arisen with a family or a family's in crisis.
Okay, so what type of prevention services can now be paid for out of the Title IV money?
So you nailed it when you listed them out. I mean, there are the three services that are allowable on the front end here through the Family First Act are efforts to engage a parent in substance abuse treatment, mental health service interventions, and then the kind of broader idea of in-home parent skills development.
Okay, and the law says it can be provided for up to 12, these prevention services,
yeah,
hence the name of the act, can be provided for up to 12 months. Now, is there any, we all know, let's, I'm just going to take for an example, the substance abuse. What if the parent has a relapse, starts using again, can they re-access these preventative services if they've used 12 months, or is it 12 months and then you're out?
So the 12-month clock starts when a child been determined in a stated kind of case plan by the 4E agency as a candidate for foster care, which is just another way of saying that sort of without the use of these services, the plan for this kid initially would at least be to be removed into care. So the clock starts when the state designates the child as a candidate for foster care. I would point out one exception to that is that youth who are in foster care who are pregnant or are already parents, they qualify without that litmus test. So they are at their 12-month clock starts whenever the case plan starts, but that candidate for foster care criteria doesn't apply to those kids.
Well, they're already in foster care, right? I guess, the candidate for being in foster care is the child they're either caring or currently parenting. I guess that's the child.
Yeah,
I
think where they were going with that was to say that we don't need for there to be the risk of removal to engage a parent or a pregnant foster teen with these services, especially, I suspect, the parenting skill stuff.
Yeah, okay. Now, but that's still, do we know yet, let's say that a parent is in a rehab facility and then is continuing to seek services after the fact, and these things went on for 6 months, they got clean, they're back parenting, I guess at that point their child is no longer a candidate for foster care. And then they relapse, and they need treatment again. How does a state have to make a further determination, a new determination that the child is at risk of becoming a candidate for foster care, or can the parent access the rehab services again since they only used up 6 months?
Yeah.
How, do we know how that's going to work?
Yeah, it's a great question. My understanding thus far from my conversations with people kind of close to the act and my reading of it is that there is no, you know, once you've gone down this path with front-end services, it does not block the agency from using it again. So if a parent was to go through time-limited services and then relapse, if the state or county agency determined that they wanted to pursue services under the act again, they could initiate a new case plan with that same candidate for foster care criteria and start again. It's not the case that, you know, if a parent has gone through time limited 4E, you know, family first services, that they would be precluded from that happening again.
So is it fair to say then that this act could be used as a way of funding substance abuse for anyone with children, because assuming that, I mean, I think certainly certain agencies, certain states have a broad interpretation of anyone who is actively using is at risk for abuse or neglect of their child. So does this have the potential to become a backdoor way of federal government paying for substance abuse treatment for anyone with a child?
I think there are probably two questions about Family First that are kind of preeminent in the minds of child welfare observers that are watching the act that I just don't think have been answered yet. One is, what will the allowable services be under this? And I think we'll probably get to that later. But, you know, like, what are the available allowable services? And then I think the other one is what you just mentioned, which is, what is the definition of a candidate for foster care? If you take the broadest view, you know, I think what you said, Dawn, is possible. I mean, if your supposition is that any parent who was using illicit drugs or was addicted to illicit drugs, you know, by definition, their kids would be at risk for entering foster care. You know, yeah, I think there is a space for a very wide interpretation that would lead to that level of funding. You know, I suspect that won't be, but I think that's one thing where the Department of Health and Human Services may have some impact on this law now, is in the definitions and the regulations that they issue. And certainly one of the biggest things that people will be watching is how they approach the idea of what can a state, you know, count in terms of a candidate for foster care.
I think, let me pause here and mention that the implementing regulations, we have a federal act that was passed in February of this past year, 2018, and so we have an act that was passed, but the implementing regulations, which I think of it in terms of, it's like it's putting the meat on the bones. It's explaining there's an act by definition. Well, you said it was 100-some-odd pages, so it's not short. But the regulations will be multiple times that number of much longer. And so a lot, and I think it's fair to say that I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, John, but that when we are saying, John and I will be saying sometimes, well, do we know that yet? What we mean is the regulations have not been issued, and so there's a lot that we're all kind of holding our breath to see how the HHS is going to, how that department is going to interpret it. When are the regulations that will be explaining how to implement the Family First Prevention Services Act, when are they anticipated to come out, or come out for, I guess first they'll come out for notice and comment. So when will they be coming out in the Federal Register for notice and comment?
So the law does not specify any timeline for the HHS regulations. I think certainly the legislator's expectation is that the process for providing like rulemaking on the act would happen in a way where states could prepare for that October 2019 start date. The one part that is actually written into the law is that by October of 2018, so not too long from now, the Department of Health and Human Services is responsible for having established a clearinghouse that would itemize the types of services and service models that were allowable in that front end piece of Family First. So it's not like a state cannot tap into the 4E funds to do just any substance abuse intervention or just any mental health or parenting skills thing. They, you know, the clearinghouse will list services that have met certain thresholds of evidence base. And that will be the first deadline that HHS needs to meet. Now, I think I've written this, so I don't think it's the same. I don't know that they're going to meet that deadline. They've just only recently put out for public comment. I think the deadline is actually this week for public comment on what types of services should be in there. It was kind of an open invite for people to recommend services from their area that they think would meet an evidence base. They were also asking for questions on how they should build the clearinghouse and, given the time constraints, what types of services they should prioritize looking at. So that's happening now. My understanding from HHS is that they'll eventually contract with a provider that will help them build that clearinghouse, and that hasn't happened yet. So,
yeah,
you know, they were under the
no
gun.
Way.
I think this law, this law was not rewritten from you know, previous attempts to pass it. So it has all the same deadlines as if it was a year before. So they're definitely under the gun to get that stuff in.
Yeah, there's no way they can get up and running by the first deadline, October of 2018.
That's right. My reading of their public solicitation for information about the clearinghouse, you know, was that they're going to make the best effort they can to, you know, focus on things they think they can get done quickly and get them up there. That's just you guess based on the reading of it.
Well, and they've got the California, and they could the California evidence-based clearinghouse. And I think I'm screwing up the name a little, and that's the model, and so that will help. They could just copy that.
That could be the case that they just basically copy and paste the. I think it is. I think you're right. The California evidence-based clearinghouse, you know, dash child welfare, CEDC.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Now, the language of the statute says that these services become available when there is a child, or again, I'm not reading from the act, but a child becomes a candidate for foster care services. What do they mean by and what's the trigger? I mean, is a report by a teacher that a child appears to be neglected, or a report by a pediatrician of abuse? What is the triggering event that will initiate this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, that's one of the big lingering questions out there. So, like, your hypothetical earlier of the idea of saying, you know, by definition, any parent struggling with addiction is leaving their kids open to potentially ending up in foster care. That would be like the broadest view they could take. And then I think the narrowest view they could take would be to say that, you know, there would have to be a substantiation of either abuse or neglect. And that the position of the agency was, if we weren't able to administer these services, or if these services were refused by the parent, we're going to have to take this kid into foster care. But with these services, we're comfortable establishing an arrangement either where the kid stays in the home or stays with relatives for some period of time while the services are administered. So those are the two ends, and I don't think we know yet kind of where HHS is going to land. I believe it was on a webinar or call with some county officials that maybe, you know, the idea of maybe letting states sort of define this for themselves. I don't know about that. I mean, I think that could lead to, you know, some states taking a huge broad interpretation and others taking a very narrow one. I don't know if that's what they want, but, you know, big to be determined question there.
But if they've substantiated abuse or neglect, how are they able to leave a child in that environment?
Well, because there is no requirement that any time neglect or abuse has taken place, that the next step has to be removal into foster care. And that is not something that is new with this act. You know, it's not as if states are removing children in every case for substantiated abuse and neglect now. This is just adding funds, federal participation in the payment for services that would improve the odds that a case like that could be dealt with without the use of foster care. Now, obviously, it's not going to be the case that a severely abused or sexually abused child is left in a home under these circumstances. I think we're talking about different levels of neglect and abuse in that.
Yeah. I mean, going back to the example of a parent who is using but is still functional, the child is certainly at risk, but they might be able to make a determination that that the parent could be helped. The act further clarifies that children under guardianship of kinship care providers are also eligible for these funds. And does that mean that the child, no, would it be the parent of the child would have access to the funds? But this is not in any way saying, is it, that kinship providers will have access to more funds, especially if they're not becoming licensed as a foster care. The money is going to the parents of the children, not the kinship care providers, or how is that going to work?
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. I mean, I think it's definitely tied to the child and the child's situation at the time that the determination is being made. So I think it's important addition that, you know, this is not only birth parents, that an adoption arrangement that was at risk of disruption or removal into care, you know, could be handled through 4E prevention services, as could a guardianship, like a formal guardianship with a relative. Those cases would apply as well.
Okay, but the money goes to I'm circling back to the adoptive parents in a minute, but for the kinship providers, the money is for mental health services, substance abuse treatment, and in-home parenting skills training. So would that be that the kinship provider would have access to, hopefully they wouldn't need substance abuse treatment, but the mental health services for the kinship provider or in-home parenting skills training for the kinship provider? Is that what they're referring to? Or is it the parent, the biological parent of the child who is in kinship care, that would have access to mental health services, substance abuse services?
You know, Dawn, I think that's a really good question, and I am not sure I can fully answer it. I know that the kinship portion of Family First, you know, is one that has raised some concern with some people, I think, because, you know, what they're saying in this bill is essentially that in some of these cases, the child is going to be able to stay home while mom or dad or both get the Family First prevention services. And in some cases, it may be the case that an uncle or aunt or grandparent has to step in and take the kid for some period of time. But it does not, in the law, you know, provide actual guarantees of funding, you know, for those placements, you know, fiscal support for those relatives. And that's going to be an interesting thing to see as this sort of plays out, because they're kind of, in a way, referring to those arrangements as not foster care because it's a relative and it maybe is for a pretty short amount of time. But at the end of the day, you're taking a kid and moving them out of their house, you know, as part of an arrangement.
Right.
And there's no guarantee of money that goes with it in the same fashion that a foster parent or a licensed kinship caregiver would be. So, you know, I think that's a big question too.
Yeah, and I think it's one that we're all looking at and wondering, because many kinship providers choose not to go through the licensing process to become a foster parent for any number of reasons. And so currently they have significantly reduced funding options to help them support this child. So anyway, yeah. Okay, so we don't To be determined, I guess, would be the answer to that.
Right.
Yeah. For better or for worse. I wanted to circle back to your comment about adoptive parents, because that's something that when this act was first being discussed, a couple of years ago, really.
yeah,
was,
2015, I think.
Yeah, you know what? Was it 15? Yeah, I think you may. I was going to say 16, but I think you're probably right.
I think the earliest version of the front end stuff, I believe I saw in 2015, because that was when Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon circulated his idea for the front end stuff, and it was kind of shortly after or right around the same time that Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah, you know, we'll get to the congregate care part of this law, but that was his, you know, initial aim, and they kind of merged those bills. I think that was in 2015, 2016.
Yeah, no, so I mean, yeah. And when it was first being discussed, one of the things was one of the real pushes here at Creating a Family is to encourage policymakers as well as parents and everyone else to appreciate the absolute need for post-adoption services. And so this act was way back when was being touted as one source of one mechanism of freeing up funds to help adoptive parents post-adoption to help prevent adoption dissolutions or failed adoptions. And that becomes particularly important. Children who are adopted from foster care often have subsidies. In fact, the vast majority have the subsidies post-adoption to help parents access care, although many would tell you that it is terribly inadequate. But families who adopt internationally or domestic infant, but we see less need there, not less need for post-adoption services at all. I'm not saying that. But
sure,
less
yeah.
need for the intense services. So what do we know as far as how adoptive parents who are struggling, their children need a lot of help, perhaps they need in-house psychiatric care or residential, or they really need help to keep their family together. How will these families be able to access any of the services under the Family First Act, or can they?
Yeah, so Dawn, one of the questions on my list, you know, I have a whole thing of, you know, ideas about the act and its implications that I want to explore as they kind of lead up to this thing becoming an actual, you know, effective law in early 2019, is whether or not the mental health services aspect of the substance abuse treatment can apply in that type of case to the child. Because
yeah,
I think what
it.
You're talking about. So you're an adoptive parent who's got a child and you really want to, that really needs a mental health intervention. And, you know, there's risk of that being done through the foster care system or removal. Can you use the construct of 4E prevention services to intervene in that case? And I guess the best I can do right now is I will absolutely, when I write that story, you'll be the first one to get it. I think for sure,
we will spread
the law
it around through our community.
Okay.
I promise. Go ahead.
For sure, though, the adoptive parent has the same ability. You know, systems have the same ability to help them as they would a birth parent under the act for problems or things that come up with the parent. But I think the question in my mind whether or not that extends to, you know, a teenager in an adoptive home or any home really, whose mental health problems or addiction problems would somehow cause them to be removed from foster care, like that their actions or their challenges would do that. That's a good question.
Yeah, and that's the one that I'm very curious about, because it's the preventative services, if the preventative services can apply to the child. Now, one could argue that the in-home parenting skills training can, because often that the, especially the more intensive in-home trainings, are really observing the child and teaching techniques to work with that particular child's special need or behavioral needs or mental illness. So, I mean, that you could certainly see how that would be helpful, and it does not say anything specific about residential treatment. So I think that's and here's the other issue that we find is that, and this is what families face now, who have adopted, and this is usually the case where they have adopted an older child, either through foster care or international adoption, and the child and the family is really struggling and at risk for the adoption dissolving. Families don't know how to access services without without having been classified as having abused or neglected a child. So if states took the approach that said that you can only access these services, and let's say that these services could be helpful in this case, but could only be if a parent says, I admit that I am neglectful or abusive, there are very few parents who will be willing to do that, because then they are at risk of losing other children, or at risk of not being able to teach Sunday school or be a Boy Scout leader or do anything with a child, because then you have on your record that you are a child abuser or a child, you have neglected or abused a child. So if they
and I would imagine based on depending on which state, right, Dawn, you would know this better than me, but I mean, I would think like some of them might end up on a registry, you know, depending on how the abuse neglect registry in the state
is
determined.
Could be I would assume that that can be. I actually don't know of a case where that has happened, but I absolutely know of cases where parents have had to, in order to get in the cases I know of, the children needed residential care. The children, they were at high risk of harm to themselves or other family members, and the parents had no way of getting their child into treatment without turning the child over to foster care. In order for foster care to accept the child, the parents had to had to have a finding of abuse or neglect, which was devastating for the family. I know one family who backed off and said no, we just, that's too high of a risk, and another family that did. So anyway, that was.
And I think that everything you're just describing is absolutely indicative of a broader need for more attention federally and on the state level to post adoption services. And I'm hopeful that we're going to get some clarity soon, I guess, through federal data collection, because at some point in the near future, now this is kind of being held up at the moment, but you know, the AFCARS data, the federal data that's collected annually, soon will be required to include disrupted adoptions. There will be some evidence of that number. And so, you know, I think that will kind of open up one of the bigger blind spots, in my opinion, in youth, you know, data about at-risk youth. I think that, and then, you know, on a totally different topic, the things that happen to kids when they're transferred into adult court on the juvenile side, those might be the two biggest blind spots in our data about kids on the federal level.
That's fascinating, and I'm very interested in that. It is off topic, but let me ask a quick question.
Yeah.
AFCAR, and AFCAR is the gold mine of data. Anytime you're looking for anything to understand the numbers, what the picture of who is in care, how they enter care, how long they stay, what their permanency plan is upon leaving, all of that is in there. Will the information on disruptions, or not disruptions, this would be dissolutions, of adoptions include only adoptions through foster care, or will they include all adoptions?
Well, I think that's one of the things that they're redetermining now. So basically what happened is, in the waning months of the Obama administration, a lot of rulemaking was done as they moved to get some things out of the way and finalized before they left office. One of those was updating the data sets and the collection rules on AFCARS. And, you know, so what that includes, I'm working off of memory here, would be caseworkers noting a previous adoption before an entrance into foster care. And so that it might, I think in that sense, it may include international adoptions and things like that. It may not be limited just to that. But I'll share an article we did at the time when they kind of promulgated the rules when I had just freshly read them, because my recollection is that it was as inclusive as they felt they could get of dissolutions and disruptions through the APGAR systems, but that it wasn't going to be a perfect, you know, encompassment of all disruptions or anything like that.
Yeah, it's tough. And again, this is off topic, so I'll let this be my last comment on it. But I care so passionately about this. I feel like so often in discussions of adoptions, failures, let's just say, dissolutions, that we're speaking in the dark. I think that the general public and, quite frankly, a lot of rulemakers, a lot of legislators have an inflated number, but quite frankly, we don't know. It could be a huge number, but it could also be a small number. And we simply don't know. There is research out there, and I have read every bit of research and interviews. A number of the interview people who have researchers, I'm sorry, but they're so darn general, and the research, you know, is so poor. It's because it doesn't often make a distinction between adoption dissolution and adoption disruption. A dissolution is after the adoption is finalized, and disruption is just after the child has been placed, which is kind of worthless because, I mean, the real question is how many adoptions fail post-adoption. But anyway, let me stop and remind everybody that you are listening to Creating a Family, and even though I have not been talking about it in the last 5 minutes, we are talking today about the Family First Prevention Services Act, which was passed in February 2018, and we are talking with John Kelly, who is the editor of Chronicles of Social Change. This show is supported by our wonderful partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to pre- and post-adoptive families and foster families. One of those sponsors is Children's Connection. They are an adoption agency providing services for domestic infant adoption and embryo donation and adoption throughout the U.S. They also do home studies and post-adoption support to families in Texas. Okay, John, now I promise we are going to actually talk about the Family First Act, and I will get off my post-adoption soapbox. Yeah. All right. So one of the things that I've read in the – and I've not read the entire act. I've read a lot of summaries. So John is by far the person who knows. But I have read that the act eliminates – and this is a quote – eliminates time limits for family reunification services. And I wonder what that means. This, back in the mid, 1990s, I think, and I don't, there were a number of acts that were all lumped together, but the intent was to say that children needed permanency and that it was no longer parents, bio parents, birth families were no longer to be able to give chance after chance after chance so that the child ended up really basically growing up in foster care while the parents get their act together. And it was roughly, and there's a lot of loopholes to this, but it was roughly a 2-year period, they said. And they controlled it by holding states accountable for getting a permanency plan in place after the child has been in foster care for more than or up to 2 years. Is this language here in any way altering that, the language about eliminating the time limit for family reunification? Is that changing the basic premise that, and I'm grossly oversimplifying it, but, you know, basically birth families have 2 years to get their act together or else the child's need for permanency trumps the parents' need for reunification?
Right. So I think what that's referring to is that, you know, what we've been talking about thus far is what this law changes under 4E, right, which is the big entitlement clause. Foster care and adoption services.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. The other part of the Title IV, you know, child welfare outlay is 4B, which is a much smaller non-entitlement pot of money that goes for generally family preservation. And within that is the funding for reunification services that the feds give out to states. So here's what changes. The current rule on that is that there's a 15-month limit on the funds once a child enters foster care. And so that is eliminated. There is no longer a time limit on the funds, you know, once a kid enters foster care for reunification. And then in addition, they also provide for 15 months after reunification. So under the current law, it's a 15-month limit once the kid enters care. And then once the child is actually reunified, the clock stops. And what they're changing that to is there is no time limit on the reunification services during the foster care stay. And in addition, states can spend their reunification funds for 15 months after the child has returned home. So it's lengthening the amount of time that you can serve a parent who's been reunified with their child, you know, to extend for a year and change after that reunification has taken place.
Okay, so then the family reunification funds, just generally, what services can they be used to provide?
I don't actually have that list in front of me, but I think that's a fairly flexible thing. There's no clearinghouse of allowable services like there is with the prevention services. That's been a part of the promoting safe and stable families. I'm sure there's some constraint. I don't think you can just do anything with it, but you know, I think it's broader than anything in Family First.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, so those will continue to help these families thrive after reunification. Gotcha.
Right.
Another part of the act, and again, this is not under the first part of it, Title 4E. It may be under Title 4B. I'm not sure. Our audience doesn't care about that. But the the act reauthorizes the regional partnership grants. They were due to sunset at some point. Now they're reauthorized through 2021. What are regional partnership grants?
Those are It's basically a partnership between SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and ACF to provide the types of services that are now, you know, a big part of the Family First front end. And so those were some of those regional arrangements were part of what kind of informed the construct of this. And what they're doing is extending that to kind of continue to build up the evidence base for types of service models and strategies that would, you know, benefit states under this new law.
Okay. Okay, good. Because I didn't have a clue. I was reading.
Yeah, it's something I need to do. I need to do my homework on those too. But they are. Yeah, that's basically the nutshell.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Now, I'd like to move on to talking about, at the very beginning, I summarized the act very grossly by saying, you know, there's the funding mechanism part, which is what we've been talking about up to this point, how the funding can be used and who can access it. And then the second part deals with the goal to reduce placements of children in congregate care or group homes. Is there a definition of what we mean by congregate care or a group home?
Yeah. So the federal definition of what's currently allowable for congregate care is any public child-serving institution that holds 25 or fewer children. And then I believe on the bottom end, I think they consider anything having more than 6 children to be a congregate care setting. So anything between, you know, that 6 and 25 kid threshold, that's what the current, you know, definition of congregate care is as far as 4E funding goes.
Okay. So can you generally summarize what type of congregate care group homes exist in the United States? You've talked about the 6 to 25 threshold. We're going to come back to that. Are there facilities that hold more than 25 kids? What are they called?
I guess I shouldn't say certainly, because I don't know the presence of every entity in the country. But what I can tell you is that there are probably facilities that hold more than 25 children. But those types of settings would currently, even without Family First, would not be eligible for 4E money for congregate care. The feds have been, you know, the current rules are that you can't have more than 25 kids in a setting if they're going to pay for it.
If they're going to be accessing federal funds, the maximum
under 4E.
Number. What about facilities that use homes with on a campus? You have a campus, and then you have house. You have individual homes, and you have house parents, often therapeutically trained foster parents. But they're living on a campus. Does each individual house is that's what's considered, or is it the whole campus that is considered?
Oh, that's a great question, Dawn. I feel like I should know that and don't, but that's a good question, whether or not they count the totality of a complex or the actual physical place that the child lives.
Because a lot of them
I don't know. Yeah.
And there's actually some advantage. There is a movement towards foster villages. I shouldn't say a movement. That makes it sound more organized than it is. But certainly there's some really interesting I've not read research, but I've certainly read some anecdotal information on these. And this is different. I guess it is and it isn't necessarily different, but foster villages where they're homes and parents live with foster children and biological children. And there's certainly advantage to living because if your child is acting out, your neighbors then understand. You've got respite care that your child knows because they're a next door neighbor, makes training easier, for any number of reasons. And I've wondered what this would do. I also don't know if they receive federal funds, although I would think these are fairly loose. They're they're not terribly organized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're talking about like a mockingbird model of having clusters of foster homes near each other, I'm confident that that is all dealt with as like individual foster homes and not, totaled into a congregate calculation.
But then there's the other one where it's on the campus of an organization, and the ones I know about used to be. Back in the 1800s and early 1900s were the U.S. equivalent of an orphanage because they had, 100 odd kids. And they have since moved to a family home model, but they keep them all on the campus. We don't know the answer. It's a question I have. But for an individual home, you can hold up to 6 children. And states, let me just point out that different states have different requirements on whether you're even allowed to have 6 children in total, including any children already in the home, that different states have different rules associated with that. But for this, anything more than 6 is considered. All right, so why the push to get rid of, basically, I think, stop federal funding for children in group homes? What's the bigger picture here as to why this is happening?
Well, I think that there has been certainly on the part of Senator Hatch and others on the Senate Finance Committee, they've held several hearings and meetings over the course of the last, 10 years to discuss what's, the quality of life for youth who grow up or age out of foster care, having been in group homes or institutions for a very long time. And that was definitely Senator Hatch's priority in coming to the table to work with Senator Wyden on this. I've seen it, kind of described that Family First used the limitations on congregate care to pay for the front end. And I think that that's not accurate because I don't think this law would have happened if there wasn't an effort to limit congregate care. So I think that what they're trying to do here is say, if you think your congregate care outlay, which includes group homes, but also includes, institutions that are built to handle kids with more crisis level circumstances, of various kinds, if you really believe in that, we're not telling you can't run them, but we're not going to pay for them for more than 2 weeks. That's the kind of basic, cutoff that they do in the law.
unless they qualify as a residential treatment facility, qualify, which is, of course, it's the federal government, so we're going to have an acronym, QRTP. QRTP, but I'm going to try not to use that. So it's Qualified Residential Treatment Program.
Right.
So if you – and so what what's the distinction between a therapeutic group home and a qualified residential treatment program?
So there are a couple of defining characteristics. This was something that got a little bit negotiated as this went from a standalone bill down to what ended up passing as part of the budget. So at the end of the day, here's what they defined a QRTP, or Qualified Residential Treatment Program, to include. You have to be licensed by one of three accrediting agencies. I don't know if your listeners care which ones, but Commission on Accreditation, Joint Commission on Accreditation, Council on Accreditation. You have to have a trauma-informed treatment model that includes the service of clinical needs, and that will also be a question that I think HHS is going to have to answer for people, which is, what does that mean? What does it mean to have a trauma-informed model? You know, and then the other two are that there has to be a registered nursing staff, you know, licensed in accordance with the model of care, and that the nurse is at least on call at all times. I believe the bill started out that there needed to be somebody present on the grounds during all working hours, and then on call at night, and that moved to just being on call at all times. And then the other final two requirements for any of these placements is that they have to include family members in the treatment plans, and they have to plan for a 6-month window of support after discharge. So you can't just be taking care of the kid when he's in your custody as a program. You also have to have a plan for helping the family out, you know, for 6 months afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there's a couple other, I don't know how much you want to go into these, but there's a couple other of pretty notable exceptions on the congregate care limits. The qualified treatment program is the biggest one. There's also carve-outs for, you know, settings for prenatal, postpartum, or parenting supports for teen moms. And then they also, you know, I'm sure you're aware of, like, the Fostering Connections Act, you know, permission to extend foster care beyond 18. Those settings are kind of held harmless from this as well. Some states don't permit or kind of limit the use of congregate care to take care of those kids or house them. But for states that allow it, they're not going to, you know, have to prove a limit. You know, they won't have to adhere to that 2-week limit on those. And then the final one is, you know, what's called high quality services for youth who have been victims of trafficking or who are at risk of it. And that is another potentially wide population of kids, or narrow one, depending on how they define that.
Well, especially at risk of.
Exactly.
Children at risk of, because you could certainly make the argument that any child who is struggling to be parented in a standard foster care home or even a therapeutic home is at risk of, in fact, it'd be hard to argue that they wouldn't be at risk of trafficking at that point, because there's kids who are really struggling at this point.
Oh, yeah.
There I've heard of, and this is all, I guess this is falling under the speculative thing, but I've heard that there may be legislation there is legislation, I think, that's been introduced that might make an exception for cottage homes, and I don't even know what a cottage home is. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, that's news to me. That's, you know, I do anticipate that in, like, this year we'll probably see some, like, modification legislation that kind of tweaks at some of this stuff, or certainly attempts to do that.
Yeah.
But I think cottage home, to me, that sounds like what you were talking about before.
That's,
you know, like the idea
here.
Yeah, are we counting? So if there's a campus with 10 cottages, and in total there's 100 kids, but there's never more than 15 in one cottage, you know, does that count or not? I think, that's a good question.
Well, and according to this, it could be no more than 8 in a home.
Yeah.
I mean, not 8-6. That may be the kicker. That most of them may have more. Do you happen to know of what we would call group home placements? in the U.S., what percentage qualify as a qualified residential? Which would be considered? What percentage would be considered qualified residential treatment programs, QRTPs?
No, I definitely don't know that, and I don't think any state truly knows that yet.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be a huge part, and I think that, you know, there were some states that kind of vocally opposed the bill because they weren't certain of, you know, what part of their continuum of congregate care group homes and institutions would count and which wouldn't.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a big question.
Yeah, it is. And there was, you know, there's a lot of money behind the lobbying efforts, some of these really larger facilities. So I don't have a clue. I'm guessing it's a high percentage, but I really have no idea. So, and this may be ignorance on my own part, probably is. This took me by surprise. I did not see this being passed as part of the budget act in February. And it was like, honestly, it was like 2 or 3 days later before I even realized it was passed. And I was like, how did this happen? Was this kind of a stealth thing, or was I just clueless? And you can feel free to say I was just clueless.
No, absolutely not. It definitely came up quick. It was definitely done quietly. And then just move fast once it was part of the budget plan to get it done, as opposed to the first time around where there was sort of a little bit more of a concerted effort to kind of promote the idea of it and champion it. You know, I think
we were part of that effort.
They hooked it in, right?
Exactly. We were trying to. I mean, when I say we're not an advocacy group, but we have a huge social media following, so we were doing our best to spread the word, and we didn't do anything to help spread the word about this time that I know of. Actually, we might have. I'm not the one who does that. But I don't think we did much, and all of a sudden it got passed, and I'm like, well, dang, we weren't apparently very effective. We weren't involved. It passed. We were involved. It didn't pass. So I'm thinking that maybe, what does that say? It's a little depressing.
It is incredible, and it's incredible that such a substantial revision to an entitlement program would be moved through a bill that had nothing to do with that. You know, I mean, it's a bill to keep the government open. It wasn't even the budget bill, really. It was the bill to kind of extend the deadline so that they could fund the federal government.
I couldn't get over that either. I kept thinking, do they not realize this is a really big deal? And then I thought, well, maybe I'm not getting it. Maybe it's not as big a deal as I think. So then I was reading everything, and I kept coming back to going, no, this is a big deal. How did this get? I guess that was really brilliant lobbying.
I think that the modern state of play in Washington, you know, if you have something like this that has broad support, you know, it sailed through the House both times, and if it ever came to the floor of the Senate, would have passed by a large margin. But you had some folks holding it up that had legitimate concerns about the law. But there's, you know, if this thing went through normal order, it would have passed. And I think that when you see those types of laws now, the only vehicle available seems to be to just throw them onto a spending bill, because they have to pass the spending bills at some point. They have to fund the government, and so they know that they can kind of, you know, get around, you know, small groups of objectors doing that, which I don't think anybody would hold out and say this is how government should work. Even the people that are for it, I don't think they are happy that this is like how things go down.
Yeah, but the fact that it worked, I guess, it's interesting.
Right.
So there is, and you may not, this is not a big part of the bill, but I noticed it in reading, and I was curious about it. It set aside a relatively small amount of money for competitive grants to support recruitment and retention of foster families. It's an area that we also have a lot of interest in because there's such a need for – I literally don't know of a single county in the United States that doesn't have a need to recruit and retain And so I'm wondering, it was a relatively small amount. Do you know anything about that, the grants for that, and what they're, how they're intending to be used, and why such a small amount, or maybe they felt like it wasn't a need?
So I am, you know, I'm a journalist at heart, and I cover this act objectively because I do think that that's our role in this, is to really focus on and giving people the best information without, you know, passion one way or the other on what the potential strengths and weaknesses and questions are. But I found that, I don't feel bad saying that I found that that little $8 million thing is kind of insulting. I mean, at that point, why even have it in there? But I
mean,
I
for
can only
all the United States,
that,
and we're dumping all these kids into, if we're assuming we're taking them out of group homes, there's going to be a huge need for foster families in general and therapeutic foster families more specific. And I'm getting on my soapbox again. I'm going to get off and let you talk. Go ahead.
It's totally, no, I felt the same way. And I feel like the only thing I can surmise is that, you know, this law was built with the idea in mind that it was going to focus on things, you know, strategies, services that had demonstrated, you know, with evidence in history that it was effective. And I don't know that we've built an evidence base for any strategies for effective recruitment and retention of foster care. Of foster care homes, and I think I would love to hear, you know, if you disagree with that. I certainly, that is something that we're passionate about reporting about, is more, you know, people that have shown that effect. I can tell you that, you know, we're going to be taking a look at in California. You know, they've allocated like more than $100 million to that as part of their foster care reforms, and you know, like we've already taken a look at a couple counties that started early on that, and it is kind of murky at best whether these things have an impact, you know?
You know, I don't know of, in the whole idea of becoming, and I'm using air quotes here, evidence-based I believe in it, but I will also say I think it's a little bit it's a misnomer at times. And so, but I know of no really strong research that supports it. So often comes down to me, having read everything I could get my hands on the last year on this topic, or last couple of years actually, it seems to come down to almost common sense and allocating. It's an attitude thing. So how do you? It's a shift in attitude of where your focus is and. But I don't know of that we. I think you're exactly right. I don't know, but maybe that's what this is supposed to do, is try to support things that can collect evidence to say, does this work? So often I think it's going to come down to the attitude of the people applying it, because that seems to be that where we fall down. The agencies we work with, it usually seems that that's the biggest problem.
Regardless of what this law included for that, one thing that is beyond dispute is that in the short term, recruiting more foster parents and keeping the ones that you have is going to be critical. If the impact of this law is that it will limit, you know, I think what the legislators hope, you know, that supported this, is that this will limit the number of kids or drive down the number of kids that are in congregate care. And over time, the hope is that the front end services in this bill will reduce the number of kids entering foster care at all. But in the short term, they're going to need to figure out what to do instead with the kids that are in care. And that's going to be more foster parents and more relatives. There's no getting around that. Recruitment and retention is a huge part of this, whether it's included in the law or not. And I'll say that, you know, just to plug something that we do, we started last year with our first annual foster care capacity report, where we go to each state and get, data related to the number of beds they have available, and then compare that to the number of kids that they have in the system. And what we found in our first time, you know, we're trying to kind of improve that as we go. And our second one will come out in October of this year, you know, but what we found is that there are, more than half of the states are either losing bed capacity while their numbers of foster youth are going up, or they're increasing their bed capacity, but at a pace far below, you know, an increase in kids in care. And so those states, you know, it can't be any more clear than that.
Exactly.
As a situation where there's more need for recruitment and retention.
You know, I just spoke at the National Foster Parent Association conference, and their executive director, she's actually on our board as well, Irene Clements, and she said an interesting stat to me that, I think it was actually in a Chronicles of Social Change article, actually. We are losing half of all foster parents quit the first year. It was an article that I quoted it and quoted that it came from you guys. I mean, that statistic should tell you something about retention and then recruitment.
Yeah.
Tell me where I'm very glad to know, and I think I have read your foster care capacity report. How would people find that?
If you go to chronicleofsocialchange.org, and the very simplest way is to, in our search function, just write capacity report. It will be the first thing that pops up. That's the easiest way to do it. I think if you probably Google Chronicle of Social Change foster care capacity, that would probably come up too.
You know what we will do as well? I will we'll add it to our Adoption Foster in the News page, and then we'll promote it through our social media, because we do have to get the word out that the emphasis has got to be, we've got to all have an emphasis on recruitment and retention, because the needs are huge. And knows what works.
Yeah, I was going to say, Don, you know, we did some, in this one and then in the next report, you know, we try to kind of surround that with a couple of like shorter feature stories that kind of look at people's efforts to do this stuff. And I think one thing, you know, one story that stood out last year was that Arkansas, you know, greatly increased the number of foster parents in the state through an organization that it doesn't pay. You know, it doesn't receive any state funds, but it's called The Call, and they focus mostly on recruiting, through churches. You know, so the faith-based community is certainly a part of the equation.
Yes.
You know, and I think that tapping into the what appears through research to be a very large potential pool of LGBTQ parents, adults, that are willing to take kids in, and it kind of sad to see that those two parts of the discussion seem to be kind of clashing at the moment in terms of like federal and state legislation and policy issues around that. But, you know, I think those are two no-brainers in terms of the discussion about how do we raise the number of the quantity. Then the retention aspect is certainly also a whole other discussion, you know, that we need
to
have.
They are, but they go hat in hand. They really do.
Yes.
And after you spent the money to recruit, by golly, retention should be
high
up.
Amen. So true.
Well, John, thank you so much. This has been really interesting to me. Thank you for spending the time and to be, number one, to have read the whole thing. Number two, to be continuing to write about this. For everyone out there, the Chronicle of Social Change is really the go-to place to get information. I do find it unbiased. I just find it excellent. We always try to teach people when you're doing, one of our mantras is, you know, you really do have to do your own research. If you're thinking about foster care or thinking about adopting, you really have to be responsible for doing your own research. But then how do you know what sources are reputable, which sources are giving you good quality information? And the Chronicle of Social Change is certainly one of them. So let me give that website again, chronicleofsocialchange.org. It is part of the Foster Media Connections Group. And let me also throw out, they also have a magazine called Fostering Families Today. It's an in-print magazine. So for foster families, it's something you really should look into. And you can get information on Fostering Families Magazine at adoptinfo.net. adoptinfo.net, and then chroniclesofsocialchange.org. And thank you so much, John, for being on today to talk with us about, as I said, what I really think is such an important topic that it's a big darn deal, and we don't know exactly what the impacts are going to be, but they will be, so thank you for your time and your research and your continued effort to in this area. I really appreciate it. And let me say again that the resources we provide here at Creating a Family would not happen without the generous support of our partners. One such partner is Adoptions from the Heart. They have helped build over 6,000 families since 1985 through domestic infant adoption. They work with people really across the United States, and they're licensed in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Delaware, Virginia, and Connecticut. Thank you all for listening, and I will see you next week.
Your hands were made for greatness. Mighty hands for painting, paneling, and clicking the submit order button on HomeDepot.com to get that duvet. And these Egyptian cotton towels delivered right to your door. Do more with decor at the Home Depot. Save up to 30% on select bedding and bath. Now at HomeDepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Enter promo code BEDBATH15 at purchase for an extra 15% off. Visit HomeDepot.com for more information.
Right now at the Home Depot, you'll save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like a GE Appliances top load washer and dryer pair with deep clean and deep rinse options, a reliable heavy-duty agitator, and four precise water levels, just $478 each. Wash, dry, save, repeat. Today is the day for doing. With Spring Black Friday savings, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. Gas dryer extra. See store for details. Valid through April 17th.